Welcome to another episode of The Watchdog with me, Loki, here on Mint Press. We are week in, week out, covering the stories which are shunted to the margins of public consciousness and hoping to expose some of the things that those in power who rule our society would wish to be hidden. And this week we have one of my favorite journalists to come in and talk to us about his recent series of stories about Sir Keir Starmer and also about his new book, which I hope everybody will pick up. We're joined this week by Matt Kennard from Declassified UK. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm just fresh out of doing five big stories about Sir Keir. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we can start with his time at the CPS. Now, I think Keir Starmer benefits from a sort of well-managed blank slate type of image, whereby people can project onto him the kind of politics which they see useful at the time in order to support whatever argument it is they are trying to make. However, if you analyze his behavior, not only at the CPS, but also within leadership, clearly, we see a striving authoritarianism, actually. But also with, you know, the first in your series of stories about, or your recent series of stories about Keir Starmer, you also see somebody that wasn't really shy about getting what he could out of the public purse. So, you know, your first story looks at his expenses when he was heading up the CPS. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, just to go back to what you started with, which is his reputation, which is carefully calibrated by him and people around him and is based on quite thin evidence, really. So the main part of his sort of I'm a progressive champion reputation is about his representation of the McLibel Two, who was sued by McDonald's a number of years ago over claims they made in a leaflet, and yep. He represented them pro bono. There's that, and then he wrote this one article during the lead up to the war in Iraq where he said that the war in Iraq was illegal.
Yeah.
But as soon as, I mean, I think that it worked in his favor at that point to have these, to have this image, and it didn't damage his career in any way. So as soon as he needed to take establishment lines and it was conducive to his career, he just flipped straight away. And that happened. He started at the CPS in 2008. And his time at the CPS is just, when you look into it, it's marked by just how reactionary and how establishment friendly he is. We can move on to that. I'll start with the expenses. And now the expenses is an interesting one because, again, another facet of his career at the CPS is it's really, really secret. And it shouldn't be. It's a public body. But all the records that he had, they haven't disclosed any, but when you apply through the Freedom of Information Act to get stuff, you're always told, oh no, we've destroyed that. So the expensive stuff, the story I did apply officially through the Freedom of Information Act, and they told me, no, we can't give you those documents. And then I found them another way. And they showed, as you say, that this is a guy who likes living it up, essentially. And it wasn't a surprise that they tried to keep these documents suppressed, because what it showed, I mean, the kind of headline of it was he spent £160,000 on a chauffeur-driven car for the first 2 years he was at the CPS. £2,000 a week, the British taxpayer paid for that. He lived 4 miles from the CPS office. He was living in Kentish Town at the time. So there's that. And he was taking first-class flights and business-class flights around the world. One flight to Washington for a day trip cost nearly £7,000. He was taking expensive trains around the country. So this is all stuff which doesn't go with his image, which he's trying to project now, which is parsimonious. We're going to save every penny and pound. In fact, one of his slogans a couple of months ago was "Labour under Labour, every pound will count," sort of thing. So it's all, it's very revealing, and it shows why they kept the secret. It's also interesting how he's protected by the liberal media, because we're an alternative media, we're a media startup company, an outlet. There's if the stories we're doing were covered in the mainstream in the liberal press, they would have a huge impact. Of the five stories we're talking about today, that this was the only one that got into the mainstream media. Actually, got into the Telegraph, the Daily Mail, and a couple of other right wing newspapers. But they obviously have an interest in going after Sir Keir Starmer. But there's other that I actually think the other stories are more interesting because they're more revealing of the, what the man is and what his role in British politics is. And this is important stuff because it goes to the heart of the country we live in and the political system we live in. This is a guy that served for 3 years as Jeremy Corbyn's shadow Brexit secretary. He was kind of integral, maybe even the key player in the second referendum position, which I think, and many other people think, cost Labour the 2019 election, because the manifesto for 2019 was nearly identical to 2017. In 2017, you had the biggest swing to Labour since 1945. The same manifesto with the added addition of the second referendum in 2019 and its wipeout, you know. And Boris Johnson had no policies in 2019. The only thing they said was get Brexit done. Yeah. And the working class communities all over the north, especially the Red Wall, were sort of like, why are we voting again on Brexit when we've already voted? Anyway, that was Keir Starmer that played a key role. He's now obviously reversed course because, you know, it's now in his interest to say he'll make Brexit work. I think that's his phrase.
Well, I mean, they all dropped it immediately after the killing of Corbynism.
Yeah, of course. There's no evidence that it was intentional sabotage, but his history and what he was doing while he was in the Corbyn shadow cabinet is very, very important for anyone who's interested in progressive politics and how we bring it about, because there were many elements within the British establishment which were trying to sabotage Corbyn, and he was the shadow Brexit secretary when this catastrophic policy was put in place. Anyway, so and then we come to now, and he's completely reversed on it. And it's actually astounding what he's done to the Labour Party. It's a coup. I mean, I don't use that word in a hyperbolic sense. It's definitely a coup. If you get elected on a platform which is effectively Corbynism, a more presentable version of Corbynism, I can get you elected and then rescind on everything. Not only that, then kick or say that the previous leader can't stand as an MP. He's been a MP for Islington North for nearly 40 years. It's crazy, crazy stuff. So I think as a figure, this is why these articles, I don't think they're parochial in a sense or obscure. I think this goes to the heart of British democracy, this figure, Keir Starmer. It goes to the heart of what kind of political system do we have? Do we have a democracy or do we have an oligarchy? Is Keir Starmer just driving Labour back to its traditional role, which is just to present an image of democracy in Britain, but in fact, you're voting for the same two factions of the same party? So, and actually, to go on to some of the other stories, the one I did this week, which is really...
Interrupt you there, because there's just a point that I would like to expand on a little bit.
Sure.
What I found interesting, and to me, it kind of epitomized Starmer's role as this bulwark against wider political participation. You know, when we look at British history from the Chartists, the Putney debates, we're talking about people for 300 years having to mobilize relentlessly just to get parliamentary representation. You saw, of course, the Peterloo Massacre. You saw numerous ways in which the ruling class of this country was not willing to concede this slight rearrangement in terms of decision-making. So now, someone like yourself and me, we looked at Corbyn as an opportunity to widen political participation in the country. Now, what Starmer did was, and you know, it was really encapsulated in an interview that a good friend of convicted paedophile and Israeli intelligence asset, Jeffrey Epstein, Peter Mandelson, close friend of Jeffrey Epstein, which we don't mention enough, actually, said on LBC, oh, you know, Starmer's done such a great job of pushing out thousands of these people from the party. They have cleansed this party. You know, the Labour Party, that, and it also has to be remembered, had something like 30,000 shares in BAE Systems at the start of the war on terror. rather than being a vehicle through which a greater distribution of political and economic power in the society can be achieved, it is the bulwark against that happening. And Starmer has been the enforcer of the establishment very successfully. But I'm very curious about this, and we'll get onto the Trilateral Commission, because I think that that is possibly the most telling of all the stories about his orientation. But also, when we first spoke about him, you were mentioning these meetings for drinks with Jonathan Evans, of MI5, while Starmer was as the head of the CPS. At least, you know, and this is another thing that I've just found ridiculous, is the way that they've concocted this argument that the head of the CPS is not responsible for things that happen at the CPS while he's the head of it. Haven't you found that amazing?
Well, it's also when you start looking, so for that story, I looked through the archives of the CPS to see what they were saying, just to, for the viewers, this was a case in 2010 and then 2012 where the CPS was in charge of making the decision of whether to prosecute MI5 for its role in CIA torture, and then later on MI6 as well. And in 2012, Starmer was the author of the statement that said, we're not prosecuting for these reasons. So he was directly involved and he was the figurehead. So yes, it is ridiculous. And this is how they get out of it, that he has no responsibility because... well, it was made by a lower down lawyer. It was nothing to do with us. And it's just a plausible deniability, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that case is, and it's also really interesting to go to the same point about them trying to dismiss these stories. Is like, there's a lot of chatter with that Jonathan Evans story when I posted that. I was like, whoa, it's the head of the CPS and it's the head of MI5. Of course they're going to meet up for drinks. It's like, no, that's not. He made a decision on whether to prosecute MI5 when Jonathan Evans was head, and Jonathan Evans could have been criminally liable because he was a senior figure in MI5 when that case, and when Witness B, this is the guy that was alleged to have taken part in the torture of Binyam Mohammed, was allegedly doing what he was doing. So you can't say it's not curious that the person who was heading the organization that decided to clear MI5, then the following year, goes to his leave-in drinks. And the other thing is that Keir Starmer's never replied to any questions. Every time I do an article, I send him a list of questions. He never replies. But the reason we knew what had happened with that was because Jonathan Evans replied to me. So originally, when I first wrote that story, soon after he was elected leader and flagged this drinks, I didn't know what had happened. So I just thought it was drinks. And so I emailed Jonathan Evans a couple of months ago and said, look, Keir Starmer said that he had drinks with you in 2013. I'm not expecting to get a reply. And he's like, well, your research may tell you that I was soon to retire from MI5. So he was coming to my farewell drinks. There were lots of people there and I can't remember if I spoke to him. That's what he said. But anyway, so they had a relationship. And then I also asked him in that email, which he didn't reply to, did you have a relationship with him before or subsequently? And the other thing is to go to the point that people who say, well, this is standard procedure. No, it's not, because I looked at the records of all other CPS directors. None of them have ever had drinks with the head of MI5 or accepted hospitality, which is what this was. And that goes for after and before. So it's extremely curious. And again, goes to what you say, which is that who is this guy?
And for the record, who was the only foreign attorney general that Starmer met? What state did that person come from?
Israel, yeah. But and that he met the state attorney general, and then 2 months later, he blocked prosecution of Zippy Livni, who was visiting the UK. I'm not saying those two things are connected, but it shows that early on, he was still doing what he was told.
Well, what we've got here is someone that meets with the head of MI5, okay, around the period where he is having a decision to make, or at least some role in the decision made of whether to prosecute MI5.
Yeah.
What we also have is him meeting with the Attorney General of Israel around the same period when he's making the decision not to prosecute Livni.
Yeah, in London. Yeah,
in London.
Yeah, it's curious. And I mean, there's also in that article in the MI5 case, he cleared in 2012 because investigations continued after he cleared them in 2010, and then included MI6, and MI6 were included in the statement he made in 2012. 2 months before he made that statement, he had attended a networking session for ministers at the Foreign Office. Which ministry oversees MI6? The Foreign Office.
Yeah.
So, and again, I went through the records to see if any other DPP had attended a networking session of foreign ministers of ministers at the Foreign Office, and none had. So, he's obviously clearly, when you start looking at the evidence, he's clearly had his eye on power and getting it, and he's got absolutely no scruples. I actually take a different view to some people, which say he's right wing or authoritarian. Of course, he's all these things, but what he is he's obsessed with power. He will do whatever. He hasn't got a principle he will hold to if it's not conducive to him attaining power and retaining it. So
what we also have, right, to add to this conflict of interest when it comes to MI5, Israel, and now the Foreign Office, we also have him going and meeting Eric Holder at the same time as him having a responsibility in the Assange case.
Mm. I mean, this is, for me, the most incredible of all the stories, really, because the Assange case with the CPS was just riven with irregularities and strange happenings. Now, just to give the backstory, Assange, as everyone knows, was involved in the Cablegate release in 2010, the end of 2010, with The Guardian.
Right.
November 2010, they started publishing those. Same month. An international arrest warrant came from Sweden over alleged sexual misconduct. As soon as that happened, CPS was involved as the Swedes' agent in the UK. And there's basically no information has been made available about what was happening with the CPS because there's an Italian journalist, a very good journalist called Stefania Marisi, who's been battling for years to get information about what the CPS was up to because she's found some amazing stuff, even though they basically admitted to deleting tons of emails and they've must be covering up loads of stuff. But they have the stuff she's got released has shown that the CPS was saying to the Swedes, please don't get cold feet when they were saying we might drop
don't
it.
Get cold
they also
feet.
Said, don't come and interview Assange in London in 2010 or 2012,
yep.
So 2011. This was before he went into the embassy. An interview at that time could have.
Yeah.
Nipped it in the bud.
The US needed time.
And these are all things we know that she had to struggle to even get that information. So there's clearly a cover-up. Now, the story I did recently was I requested from the CPS. I said, so the funny thing is that his travel expenses, like I said, were not disclosed by the CPS. I found them another way. And so and I saw they'd been to Washington 4 times. That's never been reported. So I thought, okay, well, it's quite interesting that he went to Washington 4 times. 3 of those occasions were when he was in charge of the Assange case. So I asked them, I said, can I just get a basic list of meetings he had and itinerary and some briefing notes that were made for him? Now, this is routine stuff. Like, this is a public, he's called the public prosecutor. It's a public position. And they said, no, oh, sorry, we can't. We haven't got that information. We destroyed it. Their word, we destroyed it. So,
on what basis?
Yeah, so I said, I asked that. I said, so why have you destroyed it? They said, have a look at our retention and schedule. That's what it's called. And it's a long document. So I did read it. And I said to them, there's no information here about the time limit for preservation of documents.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just explain that? And was this routine procedure? They didn't respond.
Right.
So obviously something's going on. But I found through US documents that he'd met with Eric Holder in 2011 when he was visited Washington for a 45-minute session at the DOJ. Now, the previous year, Holder had said in a press conference soon after the Cablegate releases started, as I said, in November 2010, following month, he was asked in a press conference about it. They asked, what are you doing about it? Are you going to use the Espionage Act? He said, that's one possibility, but there's other statutes we can use. And then he said, I've initiated a bunch of actions that I can't disclose, but we're working on it effectively. Following year, Starmer's going there for a 45-minute meeting with him. While he's in charge of the CPS, the head of the National Security Division of the DOJ is also present. The UK liaison prosecutor to the US is also present, who deals with extradition. So it's, and then I mean, I can't say whether they discussed the Assange case, but the personnel that were there present would indicate that it would have, it was something that might have come up. Again, I asked Starmer about this. He didn't respond. So, it's amazing, the cover-ups. And he was integral to the Assange case, effectively, like his organization was. And there's never been any information about his role that's come out, apart from that document, which I revealed in this article. So it's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, the way that power is arranged in this country is it works around media in a very interesting way. It's such a, you know, it's one of the points you make in your new book, actually, is the importance of media in this, in the sort of stratification of society. But Rupert Murdoch is a fascinating figurehead in terms of how entrenched class power is in this society. When you look at the strike that took place at the Wapping pressing plant and Rupert Murdoch attempting to fire something like 6,000 workers in one go, it's fascinating that period of time, because you see the picket line infiltrated by spy cops, one of the most famous spy cops who later went on to spy on the Stephen Lawrence family. So yeah, the Rupert Murdoch, the period of the Wapping strike, and the way in which you saw the not only the convergence of interests, obviously, between Murdoch and the British state, whereby spy cops were working essentially on his behalf to crush that attempt to advance the interests of the employees at the plant, but also overall, you know, what Murdoch represents. News Corp has been a company that has been written about in The Guardian, supposedly not paying any corporate tax for something like 11 years. It's also been identified by the Washington Post as having a lot of its profits plotted in different places across tax havens across the world. So when you look at him in terms of a hawkish war-type position, you know, Murdoch also is on the board of something called Genie Energy, which has got oil and gas deals in Israeli-occupied Golan Heights in Syria. Also, he's alongside James Woolsey of the CIA, formerly the CIA, and Dick Cheney, if I remember, on the same board of Genie Energy. I mean, Murdoch, the News Corp Foundation, has actually funded something called the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in settlements in Sheikh Jarrah. Mm. So we have a politics of who Rupert Murdoch is. Mm. From your perspective as somebody that studies the media, what has been the importance of Rupert Murdoch to the ruling class in this country?
Well, I think he's transformed Britain from before when we were born, because he bought the Sun in 1969. And we've seen a kind of, I mean, Britain has kind of just been going backwards ever since, well, from the late 70s anyway. And obviously that's not, that there's various different reasons for that. But a major part of it was what he did with the Sun. He pulled the political system to the right. He culturally, there was a tabloidization of everything, TV, papers, because the Daily Mirror, you remember, which was, it was the main competitor to the Sun, was a paper read by millions of working class people, but it was really, really good investigative journalism. John Pilger made his name in the Daily Mirror.
Yeah.
Stuff that we would never kind of even believe could have happened back in now was happening back in the day. And the reason that the Mirror changed, and it was the same with the whole media, they had to go the way of the Sun, which was just go to the lowest common denominator, you know, hyper-sexualized, hyper-tabloidized news reporting. And I think it had a huge impact on Britain. And I think it's a huge part of why we are where we are. And as you say, he represents the British ruling class. He does that by acting as if his media stands up for every man. Yeah. So it's a real contradiction. And if you read The Sun, I mean, they're good at what they do. You know, the writing is extremely clever in how it triggers certain emotions amongst people, but it pulls people apart. It has heightened racism, and every political figure that wants to get elected has to play by his rules, effectively. Jeremy Corbyn, they went for Corbyn, but he still did pretty well in 2017. But the story I did about Starmer was that, I don't know if you saw this, but a couple of weeks ago, or maybe like a month ago, Starmer attended Rupert Murdoch's summer party, as this party every summer, where the sort of establishment go and like bow down to him, mm-hmm. say thanks for everything you do. So he went, and everyone was like, well, a Labour leader shouldn't go. You know, it's got a history of trying to destroy the organised working class. Everyone knows what they did about Hillsborough. But no one reported what I found, which was that he actually attended the same party, Rupert Murdoch's summer party, in 2009, when there wasn't even any political interest for him to do.
Yeah.
So he knew that he was pressing those buttons early, you know?
Yeah.
He started in at CPS in late 2008, and his first kind of big engagement was to go to Rupert Murdoch's mm-hmm. Summer party. And then after that, soon after, he 2 months after, I think, he went for lunch with the Sun editor, Rebecca Brooks, at mm-hmm. News Corp HQ. Soon after that, she was about to leave as editor and become chairman of the News Corp. Soon after that, he went back to News Corp HQ and had lunch again with Dominic Mahon, who was the new editor. There's no evidence that he ever socialized with any other editors from the British press. So that's pretty amazing in itself. The other facet of it is that he went for eight or nine lunches with other Murdoch journalists from the Times and the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
So it adds up to, I think it was like 10 engagements. He also went to the Times Christmas party. 10 engagements with Murdoch press, and I think altogether the rest was maybe 6. So you see that he was focusing on the Murdoch press early. And then the interesting thing, and it's always this case with Starmer, he just sacks it off when it's not in his interest. So in 2011, the phone hacking scandal broke, where Millie Dowler's phone had been hacked by The Sun.
Yeah.
And obviously he was part of the process, because there was discussions about whether who get prosecuted.
Yeah.
And then bang, he stopped socializing with any Murdoch journalist after that. There was no hospitality.
Right.
So, and it was also the case with so I mentioned the chauffeur driven car.
Yeah.
So he had that for 2 years. Embarrassing story is written about it in the Daily Telegraph. He locks it off straight away.
Yeah.
So he's just reactive to what's good in what's good for a PR purpose. But he the interesting thing for me about looking at his record at the CPS with the Murdoch press was that, as I mentioned, it doesn't make sense in terms of even what people say now, which is that he has to play the game. Mm. He didn't need to play the game. No one even knew he went. He was ambitious. He knew where he wanted to go, and he knew what people he needed to surround himself to get power. And that's why you'll see when he gets power, there's this argument now from The Guardian, people like Polly Toynbee, which is like, oh, he's just doing this to get into power, and then he'll do good things. Of course, it's rubbish. He'll do worse things, because the pressures when he's in power will be even more acute from the right.
Yeah,
they're coming in now, but he's just doing it because he's got no principles. But when he's actually in power, there's going to be tons, you know, the different influences and interests that impinge upon the British state, foreign and domestic. He's just going to wilt completely. So I think that he will probably be not much worse than the Sunak government domestically. But on foreign policy, it's possible that he could be actually worse than the Tories.
Yeah.
And we saw, I mean, whatever the Tories have done foreign policy wise, and they're awful, none of them has ever committed a crime as awful as what Blair did and Blair's cabinet, including Gordon Brown, did in Iraq in 2003.
Yeah.
Destroyed a whole country. So it's important. And I think that, like a lot of what we've talked about, it's indicative of who Keir Starmer is, that he was doing this back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's also indicative that no media again has covered this, even the right wing, which is interesting. Apart from me, Declassified, no one's been writing about this stuff,
because these are some of the sacred aspects of our society. You know, last time we spoke on this show, we were talking about the British American project, but a key context to that was later something that you, Declassified UK, published about, which is that there's 12,000 US soldiers in this country. You know, our perception of that, even at the point when we were talking about the British American project, was probably a lot less than that. So can you tell us about this 12,000 US soldiers on British soil? You know, of course, Ansa Kulas was a CIA agent, and she drove out of one of the bases and drove in the wrong direction and hit Harry Dunn, killing him.
So yeah, I mean, we're occupied by the United States, and no one talks about it. But we have the 12,000 troops that we know about spread across 11 so-called RAF sites. They're still owned by the Ministry of Defense, but they're operated by the Americans, and effectively they're American bases. RAF Croughton, which is where Skoulis was, is a massive CIA station. They're sending up to 1,000 spies there. Then you have GCHQ Bude, which is GCHQ is the largest intelligence agency in Britain, and it has a site in Cornwall where all the transatlantic cables come to. And that's Snowden's leak showed that is operated effectively by the NSA. They pay for its maintenance and all sorts. So, it's an occupation, a military and intelligence. The interesting thing is you can get quite a lot of, you can get figures about the American troops. Now, you can't get any information about the spies. None. Which is outrageous. We're a sovereign country. If we've got 1,000 spies at one base, how can you be a sovereign country if you have 1,000 foreign spies at one base? How can you ever be a sovereign country if your main intelligence agency has one of its main sites being run by a foreign intelligence agency? But it's all assumed that we are just the 51st state, and effectively we are. And it even goes to go back to the Assange case. And one of the most amazing things about the Assange case was it shows that our judiciary is occupied by the Americans effectively. It's outrageous what's happened in the legal process with Assange.
Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, like just to pluck one example, Rebecca Vincent, who is the international advocacy head at Reporters Without Borders, a mainstream press freedom group. She said getting access to Assange in Belmarsh prison is harder than getting access to political prisoners in somewhere like Turkey, where they got the most journalists in the world in prison. And she went, she had an appointment booked, and they refused her to go in. That's the prison system. And it's outrageous. It wasn't reported. They get away with it because it's not reported. In a functioning democratic society with a functioning media, that would be front page of every paper. Yeah. A journalist is in prison for 4 or 5 years for publishing evidence of war crimes. But secondly, even civil society can't get access to him.
Yeah.
But that's the sort of prison. I've done so many stories about the legal. I don't want to bore people with it, but the actual legal process itself has just been so obviously politicized. I'll just give you one example. Again, only reported by myself and Declassified. We found that Operation Pelican, which was the secret police operation to spring Assange from his asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, 18 UK government staff were assigned to that.
Yeah.
18 government staff. So asylum is a right enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. Ecuador is a friendly country, so he should have been given safe passage out. It's completely outrageous that not only they didn't do that, but they put 18 staff on the police operation to get him out.
Yeah.
Again, we reported that. No one else has reported it. Just as a kicker to that, the Foreign Office were accused of misleading Parliament by not revealing that they had 3 staff when they were asked by an MP. Anyway, so this I could literally talk for days about all the examples, but one of the most scariest part of the Assange thing is how the judiciary has been captured by the state, but not only the UK state, by the American state.
Yeah.
You have now, just to finish with this, which is so outrageous, it's Orwellian. You have a journalist who published evidence of war crimes, who's been approved to be extradited by the UK judiciary to a country which is on record as plotting to assassinate him, and on record as spying on his privileged conversation with his lawyers.
Even within the women's toilet of the embassy.
So there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that's come out which would stop it, because due process has been thrown out the window, doesn't exist. He's a political prisoner, and he's being persecuted by political forces within Britain and the United States. So the whole of our society is imbued. And actually, I'll finish with this, and it relates to the to Starmer, because the CIA has always been much more concerned with the left in Britain. And I don't think that's just the case in Britain. I think that's around the world, because during the Cold War, there was fear that different countries were going to go communist. But also, they what's called anti-Americanism, but anti-American imperialism doesn't really exist on the right. It's not they don't need to worry about the conservatives. They've never been in a position where they're saying, "Oh, we don't want you to invade somewhere." They're saying, "How can we get involved?" You know. Whereas the left, there's elements. They don't rise up to the top very often. We saw it with Corbyn. We saw it with Michael Foot. That's probably the only two occasions. I mean, Harold Wilson, although he didn't send troops to Vietnam, he was an Atlanticist. Kevin Attlee was definitely an Atlanticist. Yeah, yeah. So they want to maintain that, the left. You mentioned the British American Project. That was one part of it. But there's many different parts of it. And I think that the reason they get away with it is because it's just not reported. Like, if it was reported in the way that they report, say, the European Union with Brexit, which is that we want to be a sovereign country.
Yeah.
We want to make our own laws.
Yeah, yeah.
All those people, Nigel Farage has never mentioned the fact that there's 12,000 troops. He's never mentioned the fact there's a base with 1,000 spies from a foreign power here. It's not problematized in any way for them.
And so then where does this organization, the Trilateral Commission, which has had Rory Stewart, which has had Michael Gove, which has had Jeffrey Epstein, which has had George Bush, I think Kissinger.
Yeah, some of those that to my knowledge, haven't been. I don't think Gove has.
So
Gove spoke with Starmer
at a Trilateral Commission in London, but he may not be an official member.
Well, he may have been, but so the story I did recently was based on the membership records from 2011, 2022, which covered the period Starmer was involved. But Gove might have been a member before, because what was unusual about... So just to give a background to what the Trilateral Commission is. So again, it's an elite networking group in the sort of mold of the Bilderberg meetings and stuff like that. It was set up in 1973 by the billionaire banker David Rockefeller, who was the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank. And he wanted to get together elites from the US, Europe, and Japan to maintain a sort of hegemony by those three powers, effectively, against the Soviet Union. He at the time was close to the leadership of the CIA. I found declassified documents which showed in 1958 he was exchanging letters with the director at the time, which was Alan Dulles. Then in 1978, he was invited into the CIA to be a guest speaker. Then in 1980, he went in to meet the director who was at the time. So he was close to them at the time. And then you see that US intelligence has always had a representation in the Trilateral Commission. It's a membership organization. Now, and Henry Kissinger was an early figure in it and is now a lifetime trustee of the organization. And Starmer, so not the type of organization you expect a Labour politician to be in. Now, there was some articles a couple of years ago about Starmer being a member, but they were a bit chaotic. And there wasn't a timeline put on it. So I used those membership records to find out when he joined and when he left. And the amazing thing was that he joined when he was in Corbyn's shadow cabinet. So he joined, it's hard to know but he joined between 2017 to 18. Now he was shadow Brexit secretary from 2016 to 19. I contacted Corbyn's former spokesman, James Schneider, and said, "Did you know about this?" And he said, "No, we didn't. And we would have blocked it." Because they did block him. He tried to take an outside job with a city law firm. Exactly. And they blocked it.
Which used to represent the Israeli embassy.
Yeah.
And Ariel Sharon.
And a lot of other villains. They said, we would have blocked it like we did with that. And it was completely incompatible with our policy program, which is about redistributing power and wealth from the top to the bottom. And obviously, Trilateral Commission is about doing the opposite. It's about just entrenching elite interests and corporate interests and state interests. So that was the story, is that he joined and didn't tell them. And then he left it between 2000 and 21 and 22. And he attended one meeting in 2017 in London, alongside, as you mentioned, Michael Gove, and there's a Lord called Lord Maud, who's a Conservative peer. They talked about Brexit. And that, later that day, the former head of MI5, Eliza Manningham-Buller, spoke alongside the former head of GCHQ, David Owen. So this is the kind of milieu that there is. And again, Keir Starmer's a public figure. He's Labour leader. He's formerly DPP. I asked him just some basic questions. When did you join? This is stuff in a democratic society that politicians should have to disclose, or at least reply. No reply. Yeah. So, and just the kind of kicker to this is that he served on Trilateral Commission alongside two former heads of the CIA, including David Petraeus, who was head of the CIA from 2011 to 12, and the former head, George W. Bush's head of US National Intelligence, John Negroponte, who has a pretty unsavory history in Central America as well, if anyone wants to look into that. So these are really, really unsavory people connected to deep parts of the state that he was serving alongside while he was in Corbyn's cabinet. Now, this is where it gets important, because we know that CIA was trying to sabotage CND, Michael Foot, and other left-wing forces in Britain in the 80s. We know that. That's come out. We don't know what they were doing during the Corbyn years, but we know that Mike Pompeo came in 2019 and was recorded saying privately, saying, "We will do our level best," that's the quote, "to stop Corbyn getting elected. It's too late to try stuff when it's already happened, so we'll do it now."
And he spoke about a gauntlet being laid out, which implies that they had knowledge, at least, of traps and obstacles that
of course I mean CIA are, they're veterans in overthrowing and overthrowing democratic governments that are not conducive to the US interest, but also sabotaging political projects that are not conducive.
And as you mentioned before, there are documents indicating that the CIA were at least watching or tracking Corbyn since what, the 70s?
80s, yeah.
The 80s.
Well, and interestingly, Mike Pompeo wasn't just some congressman when he said that. He was the Secretary of State of the US, so his foreign minister. The previous year, he'd been the director of the CIA. So, and at the time he made that speech, well, it wasn't a speech, actually, it was recorded privately saying it. So, and it got leaked. But at the time he made that statement in London, Keir Starmer was on the Trilateral Commission alongside with these two former heads of the CIA. So it's interesting. And then I interviewed Corbyn last year and asked him about it, which is interesting in itself because no one's ever asked Corbyn about it. Everyone goes on about Russian interference in Britain, which exists, but is minimal really compared to what you see with the US, what we've talked about, the military occupation, intelligence occupation. No one's even asked him about it. And they said to me, he said the quote was, he thought that Pompeo was sending him a quite deliberate message.
Yeah.
So interesting. And then he said, and then he brought up the CIA organized overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. He brought that up. So it's important stuff.
It stands alongside Gough Whitlam in Australia. It stands alongside the multitude of coups and overthrows of democratically elected leaders that have taken place in the global South since Second World War. And in a way, what we've pointed out through this episode is there are at least five major instances of serious conflicts of interest when we look at Keir Starmer's past. Mm. So number one, you have his meetings with Jonathan Evans of the MI5. Around the same time he's dealing with the MI5 cases, you have the meetings with Eric Holder, which the evidence was then destroyed for. Same time he's dealing with the Julian Assange stuff. You have the meeting with the Israeli Attorney General around the same time he's dealing with the decision not to prosecute Livni in this country. And as you pointed out here, you have this example of the Trilateral Commission as an organization, including the CIA as a member organization and even officers on it at the same time, key CIA figures, massive giants of the CIA. You know, when you're talking about David Petraeus, you are not talking about small fry here. This is a serious individual. And these are people that were shoulder to shoulder with Keir Starmer at the same time as they would be involved in mechanisms to subvert the achieving of a more just society and subverting Corbyn. So all of these things show you a political orientation of a person. And it's absolutely vital that people are realistic about who this Keir Starmer is. Now, just before we finish, Matt, I think it's important that we ask you about your new book that has come out, Silent Coup. And also, you dedicate it to Gavin McFadden. Can you tell us a bit about Gavin McFadden?
Yeah, definitely. He was an amazing man. The funny thing, not many people know this. So he was the an investigative journalist over decades and founded the Center for Investigative Journalism around the time of the war in Iraq to increase the possibility of good quality adversarial public interest journalism in Britain and around the world, because it was about training journalists from around the world. He became a mentor to Julian Assange. So he very close to Julian Assange. He was actually, back in the 60s, the political mentor to Bernie Sanders. Not many people know that. He kind of politicized Bernie Sanders. But Gavin stayed as radical as he was back then. I think Bernie's got a bit more moderate. The reason we dedicated it to him was because the book started when we joined the Center for Investigative Journalism as fellows in 2014. And he said to us, look, I mean, he's probably the only person that runs a sort of mainstream organization that is a complete anarchist. So he was like, look, you've got 2 years to do whatever you want. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to live on. And you've got a travel budget and you can go where you want. So I started with Claire Provost, who was a journalist at The Guardian. She quit to take this job at the CIJ. So we were talking and we were just like, wow, we're probably never going to get this opportunity again. And I don't think we will. Times are different now as well with family and all that. I don't think I can do what we did. But we said we should be as ambitious as possible. And Claire had just been covering aid and development at The Guardian. She's a data journalist. And I'd been at the FT a couple of years before and been covering some of the World Bank and the IMF. And I'd been in Washington. And we both sort of were talking about what the biggest issue in the world is for us, and we just decided it was corporate power. And to summarize how the corporation as an entity, as an instrument, has eaten the state that created it. And I don't think, I really believe that you can't understand the world we live in unless you see it through that lens, because there has been a war going on since for 400 years, effectively, when the first joint stock company was invented in Britain, actually, in 1555. It was called the Muscovy Company. And back then, I can give you a brief history, but back then, a corporation was chartered by the crown. So the king or queen would give you a charter and you could start a company. And usually it would be for one project or like a bridge, or it would be a trade route. So the trade route to India or the trade route to Russia in this case. So they were given but what's happened is, since that time, the corporation, to cut a long story short, has been unleashed from the state. And back then, the crown could just say, no, we don't want that. We don't like the charter anymore. Get rid of it. Now the corporation runs the state.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we embarked.
That was the mercantile period.
Yeah. Mm. And the main changes in terms of legislative changes that the modern corporation was born was in the 19th century in England. So there was one thing particularly which kind of unleashed the corporation was, limited liability, because back in the day, if you were part of a corporation and you were sued, for example, you went bankrupt, they could take all your assets, not just what you'd invested in the corporation. It was called unlimited liability. So it made people a lot more nervous about getting involved in corporate activity, because they were like, well, I'll lose everything if we go bankrupt. But they enacted in the 19th century limited liability. So you only lose what you put in. It was huge. Sounds kind of niche, but it was a hugely important thing. The other majorly important part of sort of unleashing the corporation was you stopped needing to get a charter from the crown or later on the parliament.
Yeah.
And you, all you need to do is what is now a routine act of registration. Anyone can tomorrow can open a corporation.
So it's sort of a structure of irresponsibility. Now,
yeah, and also just can, wildness. When there was no one controlling it. And then, so still in the 19th century, Britain was by far the most important economy in the world. But then the sort of age of the multinational, which happened in the 20th century, America took on the mantle. And that's why all the major corporations that we know now, or like the really famous ones, are the American ones. But the book, I'm giving a very quick summary here, but the book focuses more on what happened post 1945. Because what happened was, in the aftermath of the Second World War, there was a huge move for independence around the world. India threw off the shackles of the British. Countless countries in Africa did the same. The British, Asia, and all the elites were panicking because they were saying, "How we're going to lose our control." Mm. And you had proper liberation leaders in power, people who had been fighting on the streets, the British or the French. Were prime ministers and presidents.
Mm-hmm.
So people who really had these were serious people, you know? And they said, we need to create a framework which operates above the heads of national governments and allows us to maintain our investments and maintain our control in the developing world. So they set about that. I mean, it started effectively in the Bretton Woods meeting, which happened in 1944 towards the end of the Second World War. There was a meeting in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, where effectively the US and the UK, UK was represented by John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist. There was an American called Harry Dexter White, and they negotiated the Bretton Woods institutions, which were the IMF and the World Bank. And then a couple of years later, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs was created. Now, all this sounds like obscure stuff, but it's the infrastructure which created the world economy that we live in. And so we focused particularly on the World Bank because the IMF was about monetary stability. So countries in crisis, giving liquidity or stuff like that. And then GATT was about trade. GATT eventually became the WTO in 1995. But we focused on the World Bank because the World Bank was about development. Development, again, sounds boring, but what it describes is how most of the world runs their economy. How do you develop a country? And the World Bank, that was what its role was. And we focused on one particular institution which was created in 1966 called ICSID, the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. And 1966 was an interesting time because Ghana just got independence. Lots of African countries went independent in the 60s. And so they were like, we need a system that ensures that we can just maintain control. So what was ICSID? It was about allowing corporations or investors to sue countries for enacting policies they don't like. So when you get a liberation leader in Ghana, says, I want to nationalize that mine, I want to nationalize that oil company.
Yeah.
Now you have a legal mechanism where you can just not only take them to court if they do it, but also policy chill. They'll know when, and this is what you see it all around the world now, it's become a monster. You see, like, this system is a consideration for countries all around the world. Am I going to get sued if I do this? So. Yeah. There's a example in Honduras now. They wanted to change their special economic zone policy. They're just getting hit with a lawsuit for $11 billion. and we saw internal documents from government deliberations about all sorts of multinational projects. And the ISD, it's called the ISDS, the system, Investor State Dispute Settlement, is a consideration at all times.
Yeah.
And they should be thinking about the people. Anyway, it was interesting. I'll just finish with this with the 1966 date as well, because the guy who kind of conceived of this system of allowing corporations to sue states in international venues was a German banker called Hermann Abs. And he made this speech in 1957 where he said, look, we have the Iranian coup, 1953. Prime Minister Mossadegh nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company, wanted to give a bit more to the Iranian people to the detriment of British investors. So CIA, MI6 took him out. Following year in Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz, a social democratic president, distributed a little bit of land from the United Fruit Company to peasants. Again, CIA took him out. 1956, President Nasser in Egypt nationalizes the Suez Canal. Yes, there's an invasion by France, Israel, and Britain. Now, he's making a speech in San Francisco in 1957, referencing all these things, because obviously this is the year after Suez. And he's saying, we don't want to have to go in hard like this. We don't want a system where we have to keep doing coups and like just getting rid of leaders that are, we want to create a system where they can't move.
Yeah.
And it worked. So ISDS is one part of that. There's lots of others. So the book goes into a lot, many other parts of it. And the upshot is there's an international infrastructure, a web of control, which means even if a liberation leader gets into power, they can't move. Most sort of profound experience in the reporting of it, because we went to 25 countries to look into this stuff, was in El Salvador, where we interviewed one of the ministers, and it was then run by the FMLN, which was the political party which came out of the Marxist guerrillas in the 80s that were fighting the military, the US-backed military government. They lost eventually, but anyway, we said, okay, well look, you're ostensibly a Marxist and you're doing nothing when you're in power. And he said to us, we can't move. This infrastructure that I'm talking about has pushed you in. If you nationalize that thing, you're going to get hit with a lawsuit. If you tax the rich a bit more, you're going to get taken out by some US-backed civil society. There's a whole way of doing it, which basically just means you've got to run your economy in the interests of international capital and transnational corporations. And then obviously there's the hidden hand if you go against it, it takes you out. We saw one leader which successfully took on the whole system, and all the leaders kind of that have taken on the system successfully have been in Latin America. But Bolivia, there was a coup against Evo Morales in 2019. They tried a coup against Chavez in 2002. We saw what they did in Ecuador when under Moreno, which was effectively a coup. He was elected on a platform which he went against, kind of like Starmer, you know. So the book was just it was an amazing experience, because I went into it thinking that corporate power is the most important issue of the day, and I came out thinking, yeah, I still think the same thing. I mean, we get criticisms because there's parts of the left which I understand. It's the debate that we need to have, is that they focus on the state and they send the state. But I think even if you think the state has power, so the state does have nominal power; it can do things that the corporation can't. But those decisions are being made in the interests of corporations, because the mechanisms are in place for the corporations to exert control on them. So it's not just the corporations exerting power. It's corporations exerting power through the state.
Yeah.
And everywhere I went, and I was talking to peasants who were fighting corporate power or activists in Colombia. We went to Colombia and interviewed people who were fighting back against Chiquita, banana company, Tanzania, peasants were getting their land taken by corporations. I was always saying to them, like, come on now, like, okay, the corporation not interested in you, they just wants to make money, but you've got government, ostensibly a democratic government in a lot of these places. What are they doing for you? Surely, and they all thought that was a strange question, because
they're working for the corporations.
I'm not making it up. That's what they all said. The government, and that's what you see on the ground. The government is not. It's just being completely colonized. The government's not. There's, and I think that's something that the left really needs to understand. Is still this conceptual idea that the state and the corporation are adversarial entities. They're not. They're completely enmeshed.
I mean, even in the kind of local context, Grenfell proves that.
And it's only going one way.
And I mean, even in the sort of Grenfell case, you see local government taking the hit for the corporation.
Yeah.
So the local government becomes ultra visible and focused on.
Yeah.
And even organs of government like the BBC will say, oh, you know, I remember going on BBC Radio 4 6 months after Grenfell happened. And so I'm talking to them about Celotex and Arconic, the companies responsible for it. And they're like, but yeah, isn't the council terrible?
Exactly.
And so I found that really interesting that I was being steered away from talking about these specific corporations in the aftermath of the fire to talking about local government.
And that's very interesting. And I saw exactly the same thing. But what you see on an international scale is they talk about state corruption.
Yeah.
So corruption is the word of the day in the corporate friendly.
Yeah.
So every problem is put down to corrupt officials.
Yeah.
It's like, and then
who's corrupting them?
Yeah, who's corrupting them? It's like, what? So you're taking all their water for nothing.
Yeah.
But the fault is the person who's allowing you to do that. Yeah. Surely it's you, like you bought them off. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, but that's the whole discourse. That's the problem we have. The whole discourse is generated by the corporations. So how do you have a clear understanding of how the world, a corporate run world works, when the only information you're getting is through corporate organs?
Yeah.
All the newspapers, apart from the BBC, which is gone. I don't even know. It's like, And then obviously the think tanks, which are all funded by corporations.
And arms companies.
Arms companies.
Even the music, 99% of the music is owned by three companies, exactly. Universal, Sony and Warner.
That's it. And social media, like Meta and Twitter and Google. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's monopoly. It's scary. And I don't, this is, and we call the book Silent Coup. But the coup's been going on for a long time, but I think now the coup is complete. I think there's very, very little spaces left in society that have not been colonized. You know, like even the kind of things that what's called the British religion is the NHS. It's now completely infested by corporations.
Yeah.
Something that you wouldn't have even, and that was done by the Labour, you know, which is why I guess Corbyn was so interesting, because we've gone so far one way and then you have these guys against all of it. And
it's like a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah, but, and they managed to destroy him so completely, I guess, because I think it would have been maybe harder to do that back in the day. But there was no infrastructure. Any kind of solidarity infrastructure or kind of public infrastructure is gone. You just had the whole, I don't know.
I think also the space for psychological manipulation with digital advancements has meant that, you know, I'll never forget how the Labour digital team under Corbyn were instructed by him to push out adverts to increase voter registration.
Mm.
And what they did is they rigged the Facebook advert so it only showed on Jeremy Corbyn's phone. Can you imagine that? And this was reported by the Times.
Mm.
These are insiders, right, in the Labour digital team, made adverts on Facebook that would only appear on Corbyn's phone and wouldn't go out to other people. Just think about that in terms of the ability to sort of analyze human beings and then shoot them stuff that they might respond to. And, you know, and it was just a laboratory. Corbyn was a laboratory of experimentation of how to subvert this movement. You know, they were doing experiments every single day on manipulation of people's kind of feelings and emotions.
Well, I think that, you know, like that Marx thing of capitalism creates its own grave diggers.
Mm.
There is a, I feel that with Corbyn, because the system destroyed him, right? It was a, he was a, but he was maybe the only thing that could have saved it, because it's going so far one way now that there's going to be also, like, it's disintegrating as a society where we are now, like Britain. And that's, in the end, it's not going to be good for even the establishment, because you're going to see all sorts of social problems which are going to impact on their ability to make profits. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, in a way, he also directed people into believing that something could happen through the political system.
Mm.
He basically testified to the redeemability of the political system for some type of social change.
Yeah. Gone.
It didn't exist. We thought it existed, but it didn't.
And where does that anger go? You know, we're in Tottenham now. In 2011, you had the riots.
Yeah,
here and other places, and that was rage against that police brutality, and a bunch of different things. But I would not. I would be surprised if that doesn't happen again. And to go back to our man Starmer, I think that what it will happen with him is he will be elected in the next election, because the Tories are so awful and people are crying out for a change. And I think Corbyn would have got elected with this without the second referendum in 2019, but he'll get elected and then people will come to the realisation, which we already are there, but I don't think there's parts of society that aren't there, that he's not going to be any different to Sunak.
Well, also, we can't forget the Paul Mason emails with his handler.
Yeah.
Right? So there's emails taking place between him and this individual from the British Foreign Office.
Mm.
In which he's giving Mason advice on how to attack the Tory government and basically how to sell Starmerism. So he's being given a layup to come into government.
Of course,
but you're right.
But everyone's going to see that he's the same as Sunak, and the Liberal establishment is selling this, has sold this idea for years now. It's all Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
he is a corrupt, awful individual. There's never been someone as bad as him. Once we get rid of him, it will be all right.
Yeah.
Sunak, he's awful as well. We just need to get rid of the Tories. They don't have, because they're liberals, they don't have the structural analysis that we live in an oligarchy and that the Labour are part of the same system. So that's obviously it's going to become very apparent. It's becoming apparent now. I mean, like, what Starmer's even he's saying that he won't even get rid of the child benefit cap. You know, stuff like that. People are coming to the realization, but when that happens at societal level, I think there's going to be all sorts of like social unrest, civil unrest, and I think it's going to get really dark here.
Well, let's see.
I don't think it'll last that long. My take at the moment is because he's such a charlatan and such a clear doesn't have any principles. I don't know. And apparently, from what I've heard, that even people on the Labour right, he's not liked that much because he's so uncharismatic.
Mm-hmm.
Like even with Blair, obviously politically, and he's a war criminal and he's politically awful. But he had some charisma and he can make a speech on the hoof and actually appear a bit convincing. Like Starmer, you just feel like going to sleep, you know?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about Blair is he even seduced Rupert Murdoch's wife.
Yeah.
This has been written about at length. His relationship with Murdoch's wife is part of the reason that Murdoch and his wife divorced.
Yeah, I heard that.
And
I think that just to finish with Corbyn, I think that he will become a relevant figure again. I mean, I think he's relevant, but I think at that point when people, I mean, he's still relevant, you know, what he said, people listen to, but.
I mean, there's also the race against time in terms of age and everything else, but.
Yeah, and also what he wants, he went through the mill, you know, from 2015 to 2020, like, and he's obviously in his 70s, wants to stand for London Mayor again. Can you imagine the level of attacks which will gear up again?
Yeah, I mean, and then
there's only so much someone can take.
Well, the problem is that he was an instrument through which the rest of us were battered.
Mm, exactly.
That's the thing, and you worry about really a run for London Mayor becoming an opportunity through which to batter, blacklist, stigmatize, and screw over a whole bunch of other people who might be somewhere in his orbit around that push.
So. I think the smart thing to him to do would be to stand again in North as an independent, because obviously he's got the community behind him there as well. And also, I think that because it's not going to be an interesting election, it's going to be the same people fighting for the same policies.
Yeah.
But the centre of that election, if he stands in independent, will be Islington North.
Yeah.
Like if you,
I mean, an amazing thing that I don't think we think about enough is that in the 2017 election in Islington, he was someone that ran against him was a gentleman called Keith Fraser, who was simultaneously a director of Stand With Us UK, which is an Israel lobby group funded directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office.
Mm.
So even in 2017, they were running someone who was essentially, you know, an Israel lobbyist in the election against him.
Yeah. How did he do?
Yeah. Well, he was running for UKIP as well.
How did he get any votes?
No, he didn't. He didn't.
Yeah.
But he sort of mouthed behind Corbyn, terrorist sympathizer, at the time when Corbyn was accepting his win.
Yeah, it is interesting for us, I mean, like of our generation, to watch how British politics works in real time. What Starmer's done, putting everything back in a box.
Yeah.
Making them like the Tories, then presenting it as real opposition. This is what real opposition is. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Because you know all this stuff, but systems are quite hard to discern until they stop working like they're meant to.
Yeah.
And with Corbyn, it definitely stopped working as meant to. And we saw all these different pressure points. And
I think it's that trilateral security state, but then also it's the cuddling between governments and corporations. Because if you think about the British-American project and you think about the plethora of US corporations that fund it, so are these passed through? Are these pass-through organizations through which funds is being directed into this country? You know, you look at some of the most visible Israel lobby groups in this country that went hard against Corbyn. These organizations were getting tens of millions, some of them, tens of millions of pounds from the British government yearly, especially during the Corbyn years. So what you're seeing is these three different kind of pillars working together and in tandem and helping each other in different ways.
Yeah, I agree. And the interesting thing about Corbyn was he literally was the worst nightmare for those parents of the whole in Parliament.
Yeah.
There's no one with his record.
Like,
there's people with good domestic records and stuff, but there was no one with his history of international solidarity, anti-imperialism, pro-Palestine. He was like literally like ticked every box for being a threat to the British establishment and the unjust system. I think that the 2017 election was
the closest.
But it also will be a majorly important historical event when going forward, because since 1983, when Michael Foot lost on quite a left-wing anti-imperialist platform, and they called his manifesto the longest suicide note in history, right? And they always play this card, which is like, we are not right-wing, but you've got to be right-wing to get elected in Britain.
Yeah.
And 2017 showed that's not true. And I actually think it's the opposite.
I think that they
need to work so hard to destroy people like Corbyn, because he's popular. You imagine if his party had been behind him, he would have won in 2017 easily. Yeah. The whole point, the establishment need to put these people in a box, because people will vote for them. People want to vote for well-funded schools for their kids.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to vote for well-funded hospitals. They want to vote for publicly owned utilities. All these policies that he had, they're popular. Yeah. So it's the opposite of what they tell us, that we need someone like Starmer or Blair. We don't. What we need is a democratic society where we can actually have a choice and vote for that without the sabotage of the establishment here and in the US.
Agreed. So that brings us to the end of the show. Matt, thank you for joining us again on The Watchdog. I hope that you will pick up Matt's new book, Silent Coup, and also stay tuned for more episodes to come. We currently have a funding drive, which we are pushing. And I would just like to say on a personal note, in 2022, I was in the situation where over 10 shows in 4 different countries were cancelled. I had situations where Israel lobby groups were pressuring, whether it was venues, whether it was organizations, whether it was trade unions. I was being deprived of a platform everywhere I went. It got to the stage where I realized that I was going to earn a lot less from live work than I had at any time previous to that. In addition to that, in March 2022, it became clear that an organization where the Israeli embassy is called a stakeholder of that organization, that had a campaign manager who, it seems very likely, worked as a press assistant at the Israeli embassy, was pulling every string they could to try and get me off of Spotify. So I was having my ability to live off of live performance cut off, at least temporarily. And then another flank I was attacked on was my ability to live off of the work that I had produced for decades. Some of that work has received millions of streams and views, so clearly matters to people in the world. I was being told very clearly that I would not be able to earn in this manifestation of who I am. At that time, I was truly blessed and lucky to have Mint Press support me, because I was connected to and employed by an organization that could never be lobbied against me. And so that was something that made a difference to my life at a time where I thought I did not have many choices. I thought that those doors were going to be permanently closed to me. Not only did people at Mint Press help me, but also Electronic Intifada, individuals there, took it upon themselves to help me and spread the word out as far and wide as possible. And tens of thousands of people signed a petition in my support. Those particular lobby groups faced a backlash. You know, that backlash was significant, but it wasn't decisive, meaning that I am still in a situation where events that I am due to speak at are being cancelled, and performances that I am due to carry out are being cancelled. It's also intensified the campaign to get me off Spotify. Within a month or so of me finding out that Spotify was being lobbied by this Israel lobby group, we found out that Mint Press had been kicked off of PayPal and GoFundMe. Money had been taken from Mint Press. It was later released by one of those organizations. But the reason I'm making this point is that to say the things we are saying and investigate the people we investigate, there is a price and there has been a price. In my case, I've been very fortunate to have Mint Press support me. And it is vital that in order for us to continue doing this work and bringing this information to light, which clearly upsets people with power, we need support from our viewers. So anything that you can do for this remaining 30 days of our fundraiser to help Mint Press continue its work would be absolutely greatly appreciated. And as I say, in my case, it really has made a massive difference to my life and kept me safe at a time when there are people with a significant level of power and sway in our society who definitely would hope that I cannot continue to do what I do. So please support us at Mint Press. Thank you very much.